You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the first Marquette University Law School poll since the fall midterms has come out, or earlier today. We'll find out how Wisconsinites feel about Governor Evers, President Trump, state tax and spending priorities, plus the issues facing the state now, things like marijuana legalization, Medicaid expansion with federal money, and more. First, it is time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a musician and a teacher.
Tony Memel is a Waukesha native who's living his passion, a career in music. He plays guitar and piano, writes and records original songs, tours the country playing gigs, and works with kids, teaching music and spreading his message of positivity and perseverance. And he's overcome a physical difference in order to make it happen. Tony's cousin, producer Brad Kohlberg, recently caught up with him as he worked with kids at Crestwood Elementary School in Madison.
That sounds really cool.
I got my first guitar when I was 13 years old. I had a friend from school named Max who could hear a song off the radio, and before it was even done playing, he could play it on his guitar. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. I went home to my folks and I said, "Hey, Mom and Dad, wouldn't it be awesome if you bought me an electric guitar?" And they said, "We'll meet you halfway." So I got my first couple of jobs. I started dreaming about guitars, learning about guitars, went to the music store and talked to the guitar guys about guitars. And it was over my spring break when I was in eighth grade that I went to Casio Interstate Music in New Berlin, Wisconsin, and picked out my brand new Fender Stratocaster and brought it home to learn how to play.
Started to dream when I was just 13. I saved my money in a jar so I could buy.
I was born without a left hand, and when I went to a guitar teacher in my town, he said, "We're really excited that you're learning to play the guitar, but I don't feel like I have the skill set to teach you, so you might be on your own with that." And I didn't get angry at him. I didn't think, well, that there goes my guitar dream. I found an empty shoebox and I filled it full of supplies like Scotch tape and glue and string and paper clips, anything that I thought might help me to build a cast. So my first cast was literally taking a roll of Scotch tape, putting a pick on the end of my arm, and then just wrapping it over and over again to make my first sounds. And over the years, I evolved all the way to Gorilla Tape, and I just have now honed and crafted my cast to be what it is today.
Dancing it, I got this fin, but you should see me swim.
As I've gone out into the world as a touring artist and musician, I've had the opportunity to connect with children and adults alike who have differences of their fingers or hands, and I work with many groups who support those communities.
You should see me swim.
And one of those groups is called the Lucky Fin Project, like Nemo from the Disney Pixar film Finding Nemo, because Nemo, the lead character in the film, has a small fin, which his father calls his lucky fin affectionately. So that's where the name comes from.
Yeah, I got this fin, and you should see me swim.
Here we go.
Some people saw more in me than playing in clubs and restaurants and things like that, but saw that I might also be able to share a message with kids. And so I started being asked to come and do a full week clinic with their students where I break down how I build my adaptive cast and we learn songs together. This week we're writing a school song together and I'm helping to take ideas from the group and melody ideas, and then at the school assembly on Friday we're going to do a release of this song that we've been working on all week.
Tony Memel is a musician and teacher.
Bye, Tony Memel.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Tony Memel.
Bye, have a good day.
Bye, Tony.
Bye. Thanks for singing with me.
Thank you.
Bye, see you later.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now the 2020 presidential election is gearing up, and one key question is who will actually turn out to vote on Election Day?
Throughout American history, white voters have often turned out in greater numbers than voters of color. There are a lot of theories for why. Some point to voter suppression and other structural barriers. Others say it's socioeconomic factors.
But in his new book, our next guest says there's a different explanation. Bernard Fraga is an assistant professor of political science at Indiana University. He's the author of the new book entitled The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. Bernard, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for spending a few minutes with us. First, Bernard, what do we know about who votes right now and who doesn't?
So political scientists have been very interested in rates of voter turnout and differences in turnout for different social groups. We know that young people vote less than older people, for example. We think that Republicans and Democrats vote at similar rates. But the difference that I'm interested in is racial and ethnic disparities in voter turnout. So one of the things that I find, that you mentioned, is that Latino, African-American, and Asian-American adults turn out at far lower rates than the white population in the United States.
Now, how does turnout among voters of color change depending on where those voters are in the country?
Sure. So I use data from the voter registration lists to establish rates of voter turnout at the state and the sub-state, like the congressional district or the county level. And one of the things that I observe is that in places, that is states or districts or counties, where there's a high concentration of minority groups, such as a lot of African Americans or a lot of Latinos, we see that turnout is higher for those groups. So in most parts of the country where whites are the largest population share, that explains why their turnout's very high. In parts of the country where African Americans or Latinos are a larger part of the population, turnout is high for them too.
Now, does it matter, or if there's a difference between a presidential election versus midterms?
So in midterm elections, we generally observe that turnout for low turnout prone groups like young people or racial and ethnic minorities is lower than for high turnout prone groups like older voters or the white population. So we do see that broad pattern. But the same consistent kind of meta pattern exists, which is that turnout is higher for minority groups, even in midterms and presidential elections, when they're a larger share of the potential voter population in an area.
So how does an issue like gerrymandering affect minority turnout?
So that's really interesting. One of the observations that I have is that at the congressional district level, turnout's higher when groups are a larger share of the population, as I mentioned. But also when you shift the lines of a congressional district, in essence, when you gerrymander in a very particular way to make it so that an ethnic group all of a sudden has a larger share of the population, their turnout increases. So this has some implications for gerrymandering, not just partisan gerrymandering, but racial gerrymandering, where if groups were concentrated, and when whites are concentrated, therefore, as well, turnout increases, not just is higher, but actually increases over what we observed before. So we can actually change people's behavior by the way district lines are drawn.
Bernard Fraga joins us. He's an assistant professor of political science at Indiana University. He is also the author of the new book entitled The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. When people of color are a smaller share of the population, it seems they're less likely to vote. So why is that? What are some of the causes and reasons for that?
So the explanations that we've used before that you mentioned earlier, socioeconomics, even age differences, those all are important. But because we see this pattern of lower turnout when these groups are a lower concentration of the population, it implies that something else is going on. And what I think is going on is that campaigns, candidates, politicians, and even community organizations are less likely to do the on-the-ground work of actually mobilizing these communities when they don't really feel like they have an electoral incentive to do so. In places where there's a small minority population, then politicians running for office say, I don't really need to turn out that group to vote. I can instead focus on my base of voters, which might be white, older, whatever else, the people that always turn out to vote at high rates. So it kind of snowballs. You see a situation where a politician says, well, this group's probably not going to vote, and they're not a very large share of the electorate, so why should I even try and get out the vote with that group?
Now, having said that, there is the belief that Democrats are much better at reaching voters of color and getting them out to vote than Republicans. Is that true overall, or does that depend on where in the country people happen to be?
So that's generally true for minority groups. Today, we're experiencing very high levels of polarization, and that also includes kind of a racial polarization in terms of party. So African-Americans, Latinos, and Asian-Americans are much more likely to be Democrats than Republicans, and much more likely to be Democrats than the white population in almost every single state in the country. So we see a broad pattern where Democrats are not just more able to get out the vote, but also have a stronger need to get out the vote for minority voters and can rely on minority voters to be an important source of support in recent elections.
I also think a lot of people think that if America is getting more diverse, that necessarily means that people of color will gain more political influence. But what you've said is that isn't exactly right. So when you talk about political influence, what do you mean by that?
So by influence, I mean exactly the phenomena that we've been talking about, which is that where minority groups are concentrated, where they're a large share of the population, they have more influence in election outcomes. That's where they can really shape who wins and who loses, and where politicians are more likely to pay attention. Now, one of the things that happens because turnout is lower for these minority groups is that election results that we witness are not representative of the entire American population. So in 2016, turnout was particularly low in certain states like Wisconsin for African-American voters. And what you saw is, because of Wisconsin, Michigan, and other states, a shift in who won and who lost that wouldn't have happened if voter turnout rates were equal between whites and minority groups. So it's not just about the influence that minority groups have in elections as we become more diverse. It's really about how representative our elections are of the wishes of all American adults.
And finally, where do you think your research suggests for people looking to close the turnout gap?
So we need to figure out what works. We need to figure out what are the strategies, maybe the strategies that are most cost-effective, that will actually turn out minority voters. Perhaps if we can shift incentives and tell candidates and campaigns that it wouldn't be that difficult to try and reach out to African-Americans or Latino voters, maybe even where they're not a large share of the population. Then I think we'd see a closure of the turnout gap and election outcomes that are, again, more representative of the wishes of all Americans.
Bernard, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Bernard Fraga, assistant professor of political science at Indiana University. He was with us to talk about his book entitled The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court says President Trump's transgender military ban can take effect while the issue makes its way through lower courts. We'll look at that and other hot-button court cases.
First, we're getting a fresh look at how Wisconsin residents feel about new Governor Tony Evers. The partial government shutdown, the state Republican lame duck bills, legalized pot, and other issues.
A new Marquette University Law School poll came out this afternoon. It's the first since the November midterm elections when Democrats won statewide offices, but Republicans kept control of the legislature.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He is the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Governor Evers has been on the job for a little more than 2 weeks now. What do we think of him?
Well, we're still making up our minds, I think, is the reasonable thing to say. When we asked about job approval, he's only been in the office for a couple of weeks. His net approval is positive, but a lot of people haven't formed an opinion of him. That's maybe not terribly surprising. I think as we go from a period of Governor Walker, who almost everybody had an opinion about, to a new governor, it's important to realize how long governors often take before they really cement with the public, or the public forms a really strong opinion of them. So as a result, where we are right now is this advantage of job approval at 49, 22 disapprove, but 38 say they don't know. And if we look at Evers' favorability, it's 41 favorable, 24 unfavorable, but 34 haven't heard enough or don't know. So it will take a little while for that to settle in. He starts on a positive note of net favorability, but with a lot of voters who are still making up their minds.
And since people are still making up their minds about Governor Evers, let's focus on the state of Wisconsin. How do people feel about the direction of the state?
They're positive and more positive than they were back in October. In October, it was 55% who said right direction, 40% wrong track. And that's up to 57, a little bit rise in right direction, but a drop to 33 on wrong track. And again, 10% say they don't know. This is a case where partisans are beginning to reshuffle a little bit. Republicans were overwhelmingly positive about the state before the election. They're still positive, but somewhat less so now, whereas Democrats were quite negative and have become quite positive. So we're seeing some shifting, but that shifting has not finished taking place yet.
What did your poll say about the direction of the state?
This current one says it's 57% right direction, 33% wrong track.
It doesn't look like residents were too impressed with the Republicans' lame duck session last month. It put fresh limits on the powers of the governor and attorney general. What did the poll have to say about that?
Yeah, the legislature did not fare well with the lame duck session. Just 31% approved of the lame duck, 55% disapproved, 14% said they didn't know. But if we look at some of the aftermath of that, we asked if the legislative leaders are trying to cooperate with Evers or aren't they really interested in cooperating. 22% they were trying to cooperate, 46% not interested. But a big 32% said they don't know. When we asked it the other way, is Evers trying to cooperate with legislative leaders? 47% said he was trying, 25% said he was not interested. And again, a pretty big 28% said they didn't know.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, which is what we're talking about today. Charles, did you have any sense that those feelings were reflected in how people feel about former Governor Walker?
Governor Walker's favorability ratings barely budged between the October poll and this one. His favorability ticked up by just a single percentage point to 49% favorable, 45% unfavorable. It had been 48-46 just before the election. So that's inside the margin of error and doesn't represent either a post office rise or decline in his favorability ratings. We did ask, because he had brought it up about running for governor or Senate in 4 years, and there 37% said they would like him to run for one of those offices, but 53% said they would prefer that he not run for either.
Governor Evers recently said that his upcoming budget proposal would include the first step towards legalizing medical marijuana. He added that it would start the process toward full legalization. State Republicans are a bit nervous about that prospect. So how do residents feel about medical marijuana legalization?
And this is a case where the public is out ahead of the legislature and the governor. 59% would support full legalization of the use of marijuana. 35% are opposed, and 7 say they don't know. And that's a reversal from 4 years ago in September of 2014, when we asked the same question. 46% were in favor, 51 were opposed. So there's been a notable shift in support, and that's without asking about medical marijuana as sort of a way station between this and full legalization.
We have a couple minutes left, so I want to be sure that I ask you about a couple of national issues. What did you find out about people's feelings, first of all, of the partial government shutdown?
They're very negative about it. 66% oppose shutting down the government over the border wall. Just 29% support the shutdown. And that's interesting because in our data, 44% favor the wall, but only 29% support the shutdown over the wall. So clearly some wall supporters are unhappy with the shutdown as well.
How about President Trump's job performance?
It's down just a little bit. In October, it was 47.50, a net negative 3. It's now 44.53, a net negative 8. So it's declined by 5 points on the net rating. That's maybe a little bit higher overall than in the country, but the drop-off is in line with most of the national polls we've seen recently.
And finally, Charles, anything else from this poll that particularly stands out to you?
Well, I think the most interesting are about withdrawing from the Affordable Care Act suit and expanding Medicaid, because those are sharp issues around a policy issue that's very important. Oh, and we should mention redistricting, because in our question, 72% favor a nonpartisan redistricting commission. Just 18% want to continue it as now with the governor and the legislature. And that includes 63% of Republicans, 76 of independents, and 83 of Democrats favoring nonpartisan redistricting. That's quite a difference of support across the partisan gap as compared to the party battles we've had over actually doing redistricting in the state.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. We talked with him about today's Marquette University Law School poll.
Coming up, a lot of big news out of the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out what's happening. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner.
The U.S. Supreme Court dealt with some politically charged matters this week while punting on some others.
On Tuesday, it said that President Trump's transgender military ban can take effect while the case works its way through lower courts. Justices also decided to hear a case regarding the transport of handguns in New York City. It's considered to be the biggest gun rights case the court has taken up in nearly a decade.
At the same time, the Supreme Court chose again not to take any action on the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, leaving it in place for now. Kimmy King is a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. One of her areas of expertise is judicial decision making. She also teaches a class on constitutional law. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here.
Well, we'll break down some of these individual issues, but do you see any bigger themes emerging from what the Supreme Court decided to do and not do?
I think if there is any lesson to be learned here, it is that the Supreme Court is proceeding quite cautiously, and that Chief Justice John Roberts is going to use every single bit of his leadership to make sure that the court stays steady and on track and does not become reactionary and embroiled in a political fray that they don't need to do. And that's just what a good judicial conservative does. That's consistent with his way of thinking about things.
One concern I've seen people pointing out is that, okay, some of these issues they said they're not going to do now. They're probably going to come back at some point in the future. It may be that these really intense political issues would come back, say, in the middle of the 2020 presidential campaign.
Well, and it very well may be that, again, Chief Justice John Roberts, trying to move everyone forward, is recognizing that the Supreme Court is not the branch that is to respond to popular will. That if you are unhappy about what government is doing or even the courts are doing, your option under the Constitution is to take to the ballot box. And I think that that is what he's deliberately doing. If you'll recall from when he voted to support the Affordable Care Act and what people call Obamacare, one of the things that he made clear is that the American people decide on these difficult issues, and they will have the opportunity to do so. And then in the 2014 election, in the 2012 election, they did. And so I think Roberts is using that as a strategy going forward. And so it's that he's going to make sure that every lower court has followed all of the procedural mechanisms, and there's no attempt to kind of jump the queue and in some way use the Supreme Court as a political tool to accomplish your goals.
Let's look at some of the specific actions they took or didn't take this time around. Now, on the White House's ban on transgender service members, it's a little more complicated than that, depending on timing, but it's basically what's going on. They didn't actually rule on the merits of the case, but they changed how it's currently working while it's going through the courts. Gets a bit tricky. Can you break it down for us, Kimmy?
Yeah, it's really just a recognition that the president, for making daily operations, has authority under Article 2 for his commander-in-chief powers, but that Congress can set in place regulations regarding how the military is to be conducted. And then further with that, the administrative agencies, the Department of Defense, should have some role and some say-so. And what's complicated here is that the transgender, allowing transgender persons to serve had gone forward and had been moving forward, and then President Trump came in and reversed that. And so it threw everything into high gear in terms of what that meant for who had the power. So all the court did with its decision is to say, wait just a minute, we're going to make sure that it gets its chance to work its way through the court, and then we will solve it on its merits. And, you know, they did that in the Mueller probe regarding a contempt citation in late December. And what they, in essence, did is said, wait just a minute, we're not going to let people use the process in some way to not let the official process, a court's fact-finding process, play itself out. Then you can come to us with an appeal, but until then, not so fast.
So the Trump administration's policy on transgender military members will be in place. That said, this is still moving through lower courts. This could end up coming back to the U.S. Supreme Court on the merits of the case, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, I would say you can almost guarantee it if there hasn't been some sort of political resolution. In some ways, what Roberts and the court are signaling is, hey, don't turn this into a legal issue when it's really a political issue. We want to put the brakes on and give you time to think about what you're doing. Make sure you've done all your due diligence with all the people you need to speak to, and then you can come back to us. That was the same thing with DACA. It was almost the exact same issue with the deferred action law, that in essence what they were doing by allowing the lower courts to leave the injunctions in place preventing President Trump from interfering with DACA is to say, we're going to let these resolve themselves through the courts, and we'll figure it out after we have a clear record that we can look at.
If the message from Chief Justice Roberts in the court is, hey, let's let the political branches of government work things out, is that going to lead to some frustration? Because right now, those branches of government can't keep part of the government open, much less make even more complicated decisions.
Well, and I think what Roberts is saying, yes, it absolutely is going to do that. And it is, I think it would be a lot easier. I think Democrats and Republicans would prefer to have it be dealt that way, because then everyone can just point fingers at the court and blame them. This way, they have to each own it. Remember that in virtually all of these issues, I don't care if we're talking about extreme partisan gerrymandering or whether we're talking funding for Planned Parenthood or abortion, the reality is that Congress at any point could step in and pass legislation, and it's their refusal to do so that gets everybody all riled up and why they start looking at the courts as one possible venue for how to get themselves out of this political nightmare that we are all in.
Talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, about a bundle of actions at the U.S. Supreme Court, deciding what cases to take up, what not to take up, and more. Kimmy, one case they're going to take up is a gun rights case in New York City. Before we get to the case in particular, I've been reading, apparently the U.S. Supreme Court has been a little shy about taking on firearms-related cases. They've turned more of them away in recent years, but now they're taking this one.
Yes, and understand that for a long time, between, I think it was 1939 up until basically 2010, there were only kind of spotty cases dealing with gun regulations. But that was clearly an issue that the courts stayed out of. And then in a pair of cases that have come down in the last 6-7 years, what the court in essence did was they extended the Second Amendment right to bear arms to apply to you as a citizen in a state rather than leave it to states to regulate and give you that right. And so when they did that, most people considered like, aha, the Supreme Court is finally embracing the Second Amendment and we're going to get there. What this case in New York City will do, and it's always complicated when you're dealing with city regulations that are inside a state constitution that can be, you know, regulated also by a federal constitution. But in essence, you know, it raises this issue of how far cities can go in banning guns or in regulating transportation of guns. So it may be one road inward of saying, you either can regulate or you can't regulate. So they're moving beyond the right to how you regulate that right. And that's the real reason why you want to watch the New York City gun case.
Right. This case isn't about people who have a license to have a gun in their home, not a concealed carry license, I guess. And they can, I guess, under the license, take their guns to a New York City shooting range. They can't transport it out of the city. It gets complicated. It seems as though the U.S. Supreme Court could say, all right, we're going to take this and we're going to have this far-reaching, sweeping change that's going to throw out a lot of local ordinances. Or they could have a really narrow, specific ruling that applies, you know, that just nudges what you can do in and around New York City.
That's correct. And good money says, if you're watching the court and knowing its current composition, good money says, Rob, they're going to take the latter approach. Rarely does the Supreme Court come in and just swoop in and you know, make these kinds of sweeping changes that would have an impact on the, it is a patchwork of gun regulations across the states. And again, you're seeing political movements after Parkland to seek out the state legislatures. And so this is a more conservative Supreme Court. And in the past, a more conservative Supreme Court has meant we let the states make these kinds of decisions because the states know best. So that's why I think that case is going to be fascinating, because it also interferes with New York City regulations and how what New York City can do inside the state of New York's ability to regulate firearms.
We're talking about this week's action from the U.S. Supreme Court with Kimmy King. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see justices rule on President Trump's transgender military ban? What about New York City's limits on transporting unloaded handguns? What should the court ultimately do about DACA? 800-642-1234. Give us a call. The number again is 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're talking about the flurry of activity at the U.S. Supreme Court this week. Kimmy King is our guest. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas.
You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how the court has been voting and arguing and deciding on different issues? Do you have specific thoughts on the transgender military ban, a new gun case coming to the Supreme Court, or deferred action for childhood arrivals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what your guest thinks of Kavanaugh and how the dynamics of the court have been shaking out. If there's any indication in the latest actions by the court, if there's any indication if Kavanaugh is going to align himself with Roberts and present a more reasonable face, a more moderating influence from what I, you know, the way your guest is describing it. If there'll be a more moderate, if he's going to align himself with that, or if he's going to align himself more with the conservative elements on the court, or is he going to try to split the difference? does he, you know, after all the brouhaha over the, you know, his hearings and the kind of rhetoric he used, it seemed like he would want to, he's trying to moderate his position on the court.
John, thanks for the call. Kimmy, what are we seeing so far?
So, such a great question out of your caller. The reality is that Kavanaugh has been with Roberts in virtually every decision so far. And again, Roberts is proceeding judiciously, quite cautiously. So it's not such a surprise that Kavanaugh would do that because he was more of a judicial conservative. Kavanaugh broke from Roberts on the asylum ban in December. The Supreme Court blocked President Trump's ban on asylum seekers. Again, waiting on this issue to see how everything plays itself out in the courts. But then he agreed with the Chief Justice and he sided with the liberals in the Planned Parenthood case. Recall that in the Planned Parenthood case, states had tried to remove Planned Parenthood from getting funding for non-abortion services. So we're not talking about funding abortion. We're talking about giving women annual health screens, contraceptive coverage, cancer screening. Can Planned Parenthood get Medicaid funding? Well, some states had said, no, we want to kick them out. We don't care what it's for, abortion, non-abortion, don't care. Don't want them to get the money. It requires four justices hear a case, so you have to have four justices agree to hear a case. Two could be in agreement they think Party A is going to win, and two could be in agreement Party B is going to win, but four of them think the case should be heard. And so Kavanaugh did go on that critical case that kept Planned Parenthood alive in terms of being able to receive Medicaid funding and saying, hey, states, you can't do that. So it'll be interesting to see. Thomas was pretty scathing in his dissent and said, Supreme Court isn't doing its job. It should be doing its job. But other than that, he has been siding with Roberts, and Roberts has been proceeding cautiously. I would also point out that most justices their first year tend to be a bit more cautious. They tend not to be more active. And we wonder whether or not there's some sort of freshman effect. You're the new kid on the block. But we're watching it closely. His first case was a really boring, mundane, statutory case that he wrote the opinion on, and that's very typical. Typically, a new justice does not write these earth-shattering opinions coming down on transgender persons in the military, for example.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Another Supreme Court decision in the news, non-decision really, they decided not to hear a challenge involving the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. You touched on that briefly earlier, Kimmy. Sort out where this one is in the legal process.
So the refusal of the Supreme Court to take up that case means that the pending appeals move forward. And what it also means is that no one can leverage it in the government shutdown. And so most of the thinking is that that's what happened here. For your callers, remember that going back to 2017, then Attorney General Sessions had wanted to eliminate DACA, and he was going to do this phase-out program. And so that's where we stood with it. The appeals court stepped in. Three courts have heard cases on DACA. The Second Circuit's actually going to hear a case tomorrow, and the Fourth Circuit has a case later on. But all three of the lower courts that have ruled in it have ruled against President Trump because of the way in which he went about the process and how he did the phase out. And they said that it was not justified because the administration had not in some ways done its due diligence and was circumventing the appeals process, and that's what they were unhappy about. It's all going to be shaken up, keep in mind, and perhaps, and again, the court seems to be using its wisdom here, because now President Trump has put forward this idea of extending an olive branch through DACA in order to get the funding for his border wall. So stay tuned, because that one is not over.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at some of the latest news from the U.S. Supreme Court. And there it is again, Kimmy, that idea that a lot of people on opposite sides all across the political spectrum are hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court will do the dirty work for them in a way and mean that, okay, well, we don't have to come up in Congress and with the president with a tough compromise on something like DACA, right?
Right. And I think that's part of why I want to go back to your caller's question. I think that's part of why everybody's watching Kavanaugh so closely, is that there have, you know, there have been these big legal fights that have come up, and that's why everybody hangs so much on the justices and their votes. And Kennedy was absolutely a pivotal swing vote across the spectrum in any wide variety of cases. And that's why we were watching Kavanaugh, and everybody's paying attention to Ginsburg's health.
Let's touch on that for a moment. Justice Ginsburg had missed some oral arguments. She's recovering from some health issues, including some non-cancerous, apparently nodules removed from her lung, among others. She's 85. This is one of the weird things about our court system, is that we are very vigilant about the health of our aging justices.
Yeah, and we've seen justices serve up until 90. I think Thurgood Marshall infamously made a comment to someone that they were going to have to take him off the bench in a box. And so it really just depends. And you see other justices like Justice Souter or Justice O'Connor who stepped down because Souter wanted to go enjoy his life and O'Connor wanted to be able to take care of her husband. So the motivations and the ambition behind each of the justices is also important. Ginsburg's health is absolutely something that you're going to hear Democrats talk about, and it's why there would be a big fight over it. If I could put on your radar, another thing that came up within the last week is that the Department of Health and Human Services has said that under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, federally funded foster care agencies can discriminate against non-Christians and persons who are from different faiths. And this is something Ginsburg had foreshadowed back in the Hobby Lobby case in 2014, saying, you get ready, we're going to have a day when we're going to see discrimination, religious discrimination against non-Christians, if you don't pay careful attention to how the federal government approaches dealing with the First Amendment.
I want to briefly touch on one more issue, this census thing. The Trump administration asked the Supreme Court to bypass lower courts and have this question about citizenship on the 2020 census. This is a case where the clock's ticking. They have to really get this census paperwork designed in, what, the next 5 months or so?
That's correct. And it seems that the first blow is against the president, is against President Trump, that it's going to be more of an uphill battle than perhaps was initially intended. And one of the things about all of these cases, to kind of bring together a theme across all of them, is how broad executive authority, not just how broad, but how quickly can that authority be put in place? What is the role of the Congress in being able to check the president's power? And then assuming all of that has happened, where does the court come in? And that is one theme you see across every single case that we've talked about.
Briefly, Kimmy, I mean, do you think that Chief Justice Roberts is doing everything apart from, you know, walking over to Congress and the White House and yelling at them to say, hey, do your job, don't count on us to do it for you?
Well, I think you saw with Chief Justice John Roberts' unprecedented statement at the end of last year, I think it was, sort of rebuking the Trump administration's criticisms of the court, that he's certainly going to be an advocate for the court. I don't think he would walk over, but I think he's going to keep using with the stroke of a pen, he is going to keep doing what so many justices have done. Going back to Chief Justice John Marshall, who's thought to be one of our greatest justices, is that they have the power of words and the power of the law and the power to have the last word in some ways. And so keep watching, because Roberts is going to use every single word he can and every tool he has in his judicial toolbox to signal what direction he thinks is best for the court.
Kimmy, thanks as always for joining us. That was Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, talking about the latest news from the Supreme Court.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Gillette ad called attention to concerns about toxic masculinity and generated some backlash. Our guest says we should pay attention to the way women and men create expectations for men that might end up being harmful.
That and much more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 7, join Kate and a longtime Wisconsin organ transplant surgeon who shares stories in a new memoir called When Death Becomes Life. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next is the news from NPR and WPR. And then, is it hard for you to describe your pain to your doctor? We'll talk about a new device that aims to take out much of the guesswork. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.